Okay, it's already 9 o'clock on my screen, so let us begin. I want to start, as always, just pointing out a few things relevant to questions or comments, some books and things that are relevant to what we've been doing. Here's a new book that came out, Sheilot Tshuvot HaRivad, Spons of Rabbi Yosef Kafach. I don't know if it's available in America. It's going to be a multi-volume set. It's his questions dealing with different volumes of the Mishnah Torah. And this one volume focuses on just Sefer Hamada, the Rambam's first volume, and why is it what's relevant to us now? Well, there's a lot relevant, but we spoke a good deal about Kiruv. And we discussed Rav Shach's position, basically, that, well, obviously, Kiruv is valuable. It's not something for Yeshiva Bachrim to do while they're in the yeshiva. I mentioned Ramosha Feinstein's position that was different than that, that he thought that it falls into the category of almost like Meiser, that you should set aside time for it. Ramosha Sternbach, this is in his response of Volume 2. He's unsure. This is not in number 454. He first quotes Rav Aaron Cutler that with doing one mitzvah, when you're doing Talmud Torah, you're studying Torah, and another mitzvah can be done by someone else, you don't need to involve yourself in the other one. But he does say that a cry, which means occasionally, not your job or anything like that, should also be involved in Kiruv as well. So with that, I was interested. It was interesting to find that Rav Kapach was asked the same question. Is it permissible, or not permissible, proper for a Talmud Chacham to stop studying Torah in order to encourage others to tshuva and to learn Torah? And his answer is, this is page 96, that if you can even bring one person back, the matter is worth it. And what about the idea that was expressed by some that if you're studying Torah, then you're involved with Torah study, you shouldn't be involved in something else? Another person could do that. This whole book has a commentary. The commentator explains that he was one of his big students. Who can say, and I think he's right in Rav Kapach's point, how can you say it can be done by someone else? You have a lot of people doing Kiruv, but who says they're as good as you? You might have a certain way of doing it. You might be able to appeal to one particular person. So you can't make a blanket statement at the beginning that I'm learning Torah and this is a mitzvah that can be done by someone else. Let that other person do it. Kapach says, even if you could bring one person back. And obviously you don't know ahead of time that you're going to do that. But the assumption is that you might be able to do that. So therefore, he says, is something you could die hadavar ra'oi v'ratso. He doesn't say it's obligatory. He says it's certainly proper for you to do. That's Rav Kapach. Thank you very much, Ovadia. I don't know, Ovadia. Some of you I only know by your comments, but I gather Ovadia is another one who's an expert in the Sephardic literature, so that's good. While I mention Rav Kapach, I'll just point you out to another volume that just came out. This is called Masorah LeYosef. Ah, okay, so you have two experts in the Sephardim. In fact, both of you will recognize this book that I'll be dealing with in a few minutes. There's a yearbook now on Rav Kapach, comes out every year, called Masorah LeYosef. And it's all about Rav Kapach's views, Yemenite practices. And in the last issue, Rav Ratzon Arusi, who's the leader of that group of Yemenites that follow Rav Kapach, he has an article which he discusses the very point we were discussing last semester about wearing talises and how the Yemenites wear a talis every evening on the nights of holidays and Shabbos. So that's interesting. Two more points before I show you the video. I misspoke last class, so now I have a chance to correct it. I said that I was speaking about issues of divorce, and how I said that in Morocco, they decided, according to Halacha, that the idea that you can get divorced, like Beit Shehillah says, for any reason, that only applies to a second marriage. But in the first marriage, they agreed, like Beit Shammai, that there has to be some like sexual impropriety. I misspoke. That was held in some places in Morocco. It was held in Algeria, some places also. It was held in Fez, for instance. If you look, though, in Revesas, his volume of Tshuvot, he actually rejects that position. Although he doesn't permit anyone who wants to get divorced, he says there's reasons to get divorced other than sexual impropriety, so I'll correct that. And finally, one more thing. This is relevant to Shaul Moshe Chazan's view about chumras. We've spoken a lot about chumras in previous classes. You know, there's many people in the modern Orthodox world, they like to attack chumras, and they point out that this is just a Haredi thing. It's really not true. I mean, it could be the chumras in different areas. But what is true is that you have different perspectives on chumras. So Rabbi Shaul Moshe Chazan could be criticizing them, but you have other authorities. We just heard him mention in the comments from Chaim Palachi. Chaim Palachi speaks about how valuable chumras are. So there's discussions each way. I just want to call attention to a very interesting passage because I think it you can think about it, the psychology. We often don't think in terms of rabbis of 150 years ago having our psychological insights. And that's maybe a mistake because often they have very important insights. I mentioned in the previous semester of Avram Shapiro's analysis of a lot of the chumras. So this is actually, I saw this in a book. This is a book dealing with the days between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, written by none other than Rabbi Eliezer Brot, who is giving another Torah in Motion class. I think it's on Sunday. It's a very interesting book. And on page 241, he quotes from a sefer from Rabbi Yisrael Isser of Ponevej, a student of Rav Chaim of Volozhin. And this is how he describes the Yetzer, the desire to increase chumrot. Again, I just mentioned, some people see that as a very positive thing, either for two reasons. Some see it as a positive thing, it's basic to Torah, that you should be constantly trying to increase more chumras, and others see it as, they say in our environment today, chumras help us. And there's obviously the other position. There's, if I'm not mistaken, there's a Pitchei Tshuva who says that, what's a drisha? On the Torah, we have this concept of bittul. That if a piece of non-kosher falls into kosher and it's measured out by over 60, that you can eat it. So today you can imagine there'll be many people in the Hasidic world, they never would eat it. Because if there's a tiny bit of treif in it, how could you eat it? Now their attitude is that, well, maybe in theory you could eat it, and if you're poor, you have no money, you can eat it, but God forbid for us to eat it. And if the Drisha says that, or maybe it's the Prisha, it's the same thing, but same author, different commentary, says that anyone who says that is actually showing signs of kafira, heresy. Why? How could it be heresy to be machmir? Because he says, Chazal tell you that you could eat this. And if you're saying that you're not going to eat it, you're showing you're being more pious. But again, that's you have plenty of sources that say that if it's raining outside on Sukkot and you choose not to stay in there, you're a fool. And yet Chabad and others, they hold differently. So let me just show you the insight he has. And I'll be translating. He says that we have to be concerned that people who are doing chumras, the yetzer hara, the evil inclination, is what's convincing them to do these chumras. Why? So that they'll be so involved in the chumras, they'll miss out on the main mitzvah. And many rabbanim have criticized this. You think about Pesach, you're so concerned about the size of the measurements, and if you're eating it fast enough, you miss the forest for the trees. No reason you're sitting there at the Seder. And you clean up your house so much, by the time you get to Pesach, no one enjoys Pesach. You don't look forward to it. It's a burden. It's supposed to be a Yom Simcha, Yom of rejoicing. Instead, it's turned into so difficult. And then he goes on, we also have to be concerned with people who do chumras. It's really a hidden gaiva. Hidden, they want to be haughty. And he says, the huva atzmo eino makir bazeh, that the individual doesn't even recognize this. It's the unconscious. Freud didn't discover the unconscious. He's saying that unconsciously, people want to show that they're better than others. They want a religious one-upsmanship. And their heart is telling them, unconsciously, look how great you are. You're one of the Yachidei Skula, one of the special people. You do this. And then he says something fascinating. And he says, here's the way you know if it's... If you start a chumrah chadasha, if you start a new chumrah, without difficulty, that is, it comes easy, and without your yetzer telling you not to do it, that is, it's not something that's that causes you any difficulty at all, that shows that it's a bad thing. That a real chumrah, a positive chumrah, one you're doing for the right reasons, you realize it's difficult, but you came to the conclusion it's something you need to do. You'll do differently, but you made a choice. If it comes too easy, and you never even question, should I be doing this, shouldn't I be doing this, he says that that's a sign that you're doing it for the wrong reasons, because it's not normal. Normally, people would say, this is what Tolacha is, maybe you have a question. Should you be doing this or not? I don't know if that applies. If you do, if you're holding like Rabbeinu Tam when Shabbos ends for 10 years, then I don't think it would apply. But if the first or second time you do it, if instead of feeling, you know, this is a little more than I'm used to doing, you feel like you're so pious, that's what he's referring to. So I don't know. I thought that's interesting. Sure, it depends on your conception. Now I want to show you the video I was talking about. If I can't get it right, Shalom will, because I mentioned that when we saw that, where we saw Moshe Chazan criticized the Ashkenazim for superstition. And here's an example where I think most people would regard what I'm going to show you now as superstitious, although maybe not. Dustin Kamenetsky got in a lot of trouble in his description of the Dibbuk, the exorcism that took place with the Chavetz Chaim, the way he described Rabbi Hanan Wasserman as being naive. What's fascinating about the video I'll show you now, which took place 2 weeks ago with a leading Kabbalist, a David Batsri, is that you think, you've all seen the movie perhaps, The Exorcist, that you have to be in the room with the person who's demons being exercised out of, but this is all done by computer. This person was a Hutzaharetz, and the rabbi is reciting all the verses, and I'm not going to keep it on more than 30 seconds or so, but if you kept it on, you'd see he tells the demon to exit through the toe, all sorts of interesting stuff. So let me see if we can get this going now. Turn off my sound for a minute. I'm going to lower it.
ותציל אותו מכאן זה הקפדה ומכוסר רוח ודאבון נפש שבא השמחה הקדוש העולה בגנטריה כעס עם הכולל ולמען שם אדנות אלוהים העולה בגנטריה כעס עם הכולל ולמען שם העולה בגנטריה כעס עם הכולל.
Okay, I don't know whether the exorcism was successful or not. As I went to my gadget here to turn it on, I noticed one more thing. Dovi Hoffman called my attention last week to Rav Avadi's comments on tzitzis, that when the Mishnah Berurah says it's an obligation to have them out, he's only referring to when you wear it over your shirt, and that there's no halacha that you have to have a tzitzis out. I thought, though, I'd show you what Rav Avadi himself looks like. See that... he himself is wearing the tzitzis out. That's him on the left. And you see the tzitzis clearly, the tzitzis coming out of the shirt. That, for those who are interested, is the idea he was involved in about 7-8 years ago of silkscreen Sefer Torahs. Everyone would have their own Sefer Torah in which you'd use like a squeegee, and although the other Rabbanim all rejected it, so we haven't heard much of the silk screen Sefer Torah. Okay, let's pick up now where we were last class. I ended last class talking about how in Italy they had this very fascinating thing, this practice. Well, I preface it by saying that I'm going to tell you things now which some of you might find amazing, and it goes against everything you were taught to believe, that Jews don't do things like this. Well, one of the things they did in Italy based on Kabbalah was called Arba Mitot Beis Din, four ways of... that the courts would put people to death. What they did is when a person died, right before he died, they would recite, after he died, they would recite before the dead person a vidui, a confession, that if he was guilty of any of the sins for which there are these four types of death, it would be God's will that if he was given his penalty, it's as if he's given his penalty and thus given atonement. And after that, some people would give lashes to the dead person. Actually give him lashes. Not hard lashes, but symbolic lashes. And they would have had other things they did to correspond to the other four, the other three forms of death. Some people even assume that the minhag, we had there's a famous, widespread, though, I don't know if in the Sephardic world they do, in the Ashkenazic world, that when you leave a cemetery, you put a stone on the grave. And I've been to cemeteries sometimes, people always ask me, I don't know of any good reasons. Say it's to show that we were there. I don't know if anyone knows of any reasons. I've looked in a lot of sources. Lots of reasons, nothing that I think is a very good reason. But some actually claim that this is symbolic of stoning, of skila. So I found that interesting. There was another practice where they would lay the dead person on the ground. and leave him there on the ground for a while, and that would be in place of skila. They would also tie a handkerchief around the person's neck, and that's in place of chenek, choking. And they would put hot wax on the dead person, on the corpse, and that was in place of srefa, where they would burning. They put this hot thing down the throat. That was what was done in Italy. I don't actually. I looked around. I couldn't find. It doesn't mention what they did for Herod, which was assassination. Now in Jerusalem, by the way, so it wasn't just in Italy. In Jerusalem, the practice was, and as far as I know, it might still be, on feel, in his article reports that the practice, some of these things I'm talking about in Jerusalem, still went on in 1971, that after someone died, they put him on the ground, and someone appointed by the Chevra Kadisha would throw little stones at him, place of skila. Afterwards, they would put hot wax on him, and then they would pull him in two different directions, if you recall, like what Sodom used to do. And this was in place of Hereg, of the decapitation. I don't know what that has to do with Hereg, but that's what they did. And then finally, they would tie a handkerchief around his neck. Bonfil, when he reports that this is going on in Jerusalem, he knows. Let's not forget, he was the secretary to Chief Rabbi Yitzhak Nissim. There were also those in Italy who had the practice of dragging the coffin in the cemetery. And for some, this corresponded to skila. They didn't drag it throughout the entire city to the cemetery. When they came to the gate of the cemetery, they would take the person out of the coffin, and they would drag the person on the ground till they got to the grave. If you tell the average person, try telling someone this in your shul this Shabbos, they'd see this as a barbaric practice. And yet this was a practice in Italy, which they did. Now the problem was that this created all sorts of difficulties with the non-Jews. The non-Jews would be mocking them. The cemeteries were in areas, many of them were surrounded by non-Jews, homes and stores, and they would be watching this, and they'd make fun of it. And it would create what today we would call a Chil Hashem. What they did is they dragged the body to the grave, and then they just dropped it in. They threw it in, just like in skila. With skila, you take someone from the top of a hill, and you throw them down, and then they throw. So if they're already falling, I don't know, 20, 30, 50 feet. And after that, they throw stones on him. So they would throw the corpse into the grave, not lower it down nicely, like we think, lower with respect. So for the non-Jewish Italians seeing this, they would mock this and make fun of this. Now, this latter practice of dragging the corpse and throwing it in, unlike the other practices, which was done by the masses, this was reserved for the great sages of Italy, the Talmidei Chachamim. The other things that they could do, other people did it as well. Now, where did they get this idea of dragging the corpse through the cemetery? No doubt based on what the Talmud tells us in Tractate Brachot, that Hezekiah dragged his father Ahaz, to his grave on a bed of ropes. And didn't treat him with the respect due to a king. He dragged him on the ground, and the sages approved of this. He didn't give him a royal burial. You can understand this dragging by Chizkio as a way to perform some penance for his wicked father. In fact, Bonfil points out that this practice was of dragging dead people, and the other things also, but particularly dragging the dead person in the cemetery, was so foolish in the non-Jewish eyes that it was continuously mocked at the annual carnival performances. Carnival is a big season for merriment. So the Catholics would mock this. For 200 years, Jews had been asking the Pope to forbid these performances that mock Jews. Not just in this way, mock Jews. When Israel Moshe Chazan comes into Italy, one of the things he does is he abolishes all the death practices. Shuli, you ask about Bizayon HaMeid. What does Bizayon HaMeid mean? Bizayon HaMeid means to treat the dead person improperly. And that's what the Gemara tells you. It wasn't Bizayon HaMeid, what Chizkiyahu did to his father, because it had a good purpose. It's not regarded as Bizayon HaMeid if it has a positive purpose. We can take, let's say, someone's cornea out of the eye and give it to someone, or we can, someone's dead and you need an organ. You can remove the organ to save someone's life. It's not regarded as Bizayon HaMeit because it has a positive purpose. this, they said, has a positive purpose. If you ask someone like Rav Kafa, he'd say this is completely idiotic. Someone's already dead. He's already in Shamayim. That's his afterlife. What you do to the body on earth isn't going to have any effect on that. But the Kabbalistic notion that this is a form. Let's say someone violated Shabbos. Today we don't have skilo. We don't have any real punishments. So this is a way. We can't do it to him in his lifetime. You can't give someone skilo when they're alive. But you give it to them after death. It shows that you're not. So it's a form of tshuva. Precisely because normally we respect corpses. And it's very important for us. We don't do autopsies or anything like that. And in this case, by disrespecting it, we show that it's a form of tshuva. I can tell you there's no halakha gishu, even though it might appear there is, because these were great rabbis who permitted this practice. Okay, so that Dov points out the coffin, but that's, it's not the actual body, right? It's referring to the coffin, correct? They place a stone on it. That's more symbolic. Actually dragging the body and putting wax on the body is a little more than symbolic. But then you see the point. The idea that, for Rav Kafa, he would say that the point of putting that stone on has nothing to do with the dead person. It has to do with us. To show us. It's all about teaching us. So the Rav Chazan, the Mashiach, he banned it. And what's significant is that the people listened to him. This shows his great authority and significance. Because this was a practice that had been going on for hundreds of years. And the Rav of Rome, most rabbis, if they want to ban something like that, which is going on for so long, the people won't listen to him. It shows how much respect he had and how much they listened to what he said, that he was able to abolish a practice that had been going on for so long. And I'm sure he didn't just abolish it. He obviously explained to them why it had to be abolished. Davadi, he points out, we'll have to look at Moe Katan. Why was he led to abolish it, though? There was actually one strange case that he tells us that led him to abolish this. It's described in Krach Shel Romi, his responsa number 13. A simple person, Chazan calls him Poshut Echad, a simple man, stated that he wanted the four mitot to be given to him. And he wanted, as for skila, for stoning, he wanted to be dragged to the cemetery and thrown into the grave. Problem was that the cemetery was in a non-Jewish neighborhood, surrounded by stores with lots of people, and they would be standing out there on the street watching the body being dragged through. And that was obviously, Chazan thought it was problematic, and he was very upset by this. He says that this is something that in earlier times was done to a gadol. And he says it was done rarely. He says once every 60 or 70 years. But from the sources I've seen, it was done more than that. But he says it was done rarely. It could be that he was trying to make it not as significant. He says, though, that in his day, everyone wants to do it. So maybe that's the understanding, that in the previous century, two centuries, they did it very rarely, once every 50, 60, 70 years. But today, everyone wants to do it. And people were doing it. And therefore, he says, it's proper to abolish it. Why? Because we have good relations with the Christians, and this will create a mockery of Judaism. We'll appear like barbarians in their eyes. They're watching us drag our... I think if we tried to do this in our cemeteries, it would make a mockery in the non-Jewish eyes. The question I want to discuss for a few minutes, though, is this a valid concern? Are we supposed to alter our religious practices, even our customs, because of how non-Jews will look at it? If there's this Kabbalistic idea, why should they alter it because of the non-Jews? Yet, the fact is that there are plenty of sources that speak to this. Obviously, we don't stop doing mitzvot, commandments, because of how the non-Jews will look at us. But there are all sorts of things that are simply minhagim, and even things that are rabbinic prohibitions. If you look at Shulchan Aruch, about Tisha B'Av, let's say you only have shoes that are leather. Doesn't mean you walk. You're not supposed to walk on the street. Maybe today you could. People don't care, but you wouldn't walk down the street barefoot because the non-Jews would mock you. Say, who cares if they mock me? But halacha is that if they mock you, you don't need to do it. For example, Rav Shlomo ben Shimon Duran, the Rashbash, important Algerian authority in the 15th century, He dealt with the practice of taking shoes off in shul. Some insisted on doing it, and some said not to do it. And he says that we should take off our shoes in shul, and this will put us in a better light among the non-Jews. He's obviously in an Islamic context. The Rambam has a famous example. The Rambam says that we should abolish Chazaras HaShatz, repetition of the Shemoneh Esrei. We spoke about this in our Morocco classes. Because all people doing are Chazaras HaShatz, the repeating of the Shemoneh Esrei, is talking, I think he even says spitting, all not paying attention. And he says that the non-Jews see this, and it's a Chil Hashem. That for him is very important. He says not to abolish it. I'll give you one other example. The Magen Avraham says that although technically if we hire non-Jews, let's say on a contract basis, they can work for us on Shabbos, holidays, since the non-Jews do not permit their workers, the non-Jewish workers, to work on Sunday or on Christian holidays, it would be a disgrace to Judaism, the Chil Hashem, if on our holy day we had the non-Jews working. Now the Chasam Sofer says that this is a new idea of the Magen Avraham, and yet he accepts it. There were some people who opposed the Magen Avraham. The Chasam Sofer's father-in-law, Rabbi Akiva Eiger, opposed him. And yet this has become very well accepted, and I believe it's accepted today by all post-scheme. I saw one post-sake who says you can make a case that in today's day and age, where the non-Jews themselves work on Sunday, they don't consider it the Lord's Day. Oh, non-Jewish workers work on Sunday all the time, that it wouldn't apply to us. But I don't think this view has been accepted. And thank you, Avadia, for pointing it out. Okay, and then we see some more examples. There's lots of examples. I'll give you, since we're giving more examples, Sefer Chassidim says that those who speak in shul are committing a great sin, and they should learn from the non-Jews how they behave in their churches. I don't think the Sefer Chassidim ever went into a church, but he obviously must have heard that. And Rav David C. Hoffman has it to respond to him. He says, you cannot smoke in shul. And he quotes the Sefer Chassidim, and he says that Christians don't smoke in their churches, and therefore it would be a big chil Hashem for us to smoke in shul. Chazan actually discusses chil Hashem in his very first responsum, the one that we spoke about that deals with Chukos HaGoyim, and where he says that about the music, the non-Jewish music, and he quotes this Rashbash. And we see from this Rashbash how we relate to things is dependent on our surroundings. If in the Christian world, one way of doing things is disrespectful, even if it's okay to do it in the Muslim world, if we're in the Christian world, we should regard it as improper. And it's not just a Chil Hashem for Yisrael Moshe Chazan. It's, since we live in the Christian area, there are certain ways of doing things that are improper. Let me give you an example, I think. If today we live in Western society, so eating with our fingers, you know, if you're going to have, let's say, certain foods, we don't eat with our fingers. If you're in another country, eating with your fingers is fine. The reason we don't eat with our fingers is not because of the Chil Hashem or anything like that. It's just because it's improper for us. That's really the case he's trying to make there. He says that we have to build beautiful shuls because they build beautiful churches. And if we don't, we're not showing in our society how we value places of worship. In that tshuva, incidentally, number one, I came across something fascinating, and it leads me to wonder if Chazan, for everything else he's saying that appears so modern, and if he also has an ascetic side to him, which I have to look into more. Because on the very first response on page 2b, he quotes Aristotle, which is also quoted by the Rambam, as saying the sense of touch is a disgrace to us. This is one of the Rambam's famous, or maybe infamous, statements, that he agrees with Aristotle that the sense of touch is a disgrace and that physical things are really something we do, but we'd prefer not to have to do them. And the famous Igeret HaKodesh, long attributed to the Ramban, but we know it wasn't written by the Ramban, attacks the Rambam for this view that the sense of touch, by which you mean particular physical things, sexual things, is a gift from God. It's nothing to be ashamed of. It's holy. And that was a big an issue. Want to find something else. Rebecca Vemden really goes to town on the Rambam on this, because he says the Rambam quoting the big heretic Aristotle, but here you have Yisrael Moshe Chazan also quoting that. Returning to Chazan's tshuva, number 13, he tells us that he abolished other practices because of Chil Hashem. The practice in Italy, in the Italian ghetto, was that the Shamash would summon the Jews to davening. Remember, we saw that their problem was they didn't know what time it was, so they wanted this clock. but they'd call out, just like the Muslims who'd call out. They'd call out, they'd run through the streets screaming, Mincha, Mincha. Chazan didn't think this was appropriate in modern times. We live among non-Jews. And you can't go walking down the street screaming. You're disturbing people, disturbing the peace. Anyone who's lived in a Muslim neighborhood and has heard that the call to prayer can appreciate that, I think. Furthermore, the old practice was that the Dayanim would walk through the ghetto announcing that there was going to be a chalitza the next day. You know, letting people know, we're doing a levirate ceremony. Anyone who wants to come. But again, Rishon Moshe Chazan says that in his day, the ghetto was not exclusively a Jewish place. And he was concerned about how this would look to the non-Jews. He gave another example. This is in Tshuva 11. When a new Sefer Torah was dedicated, the minhag, as it is in our community, was to carry it through the streets with music. He stopped that. He didn't think it was something the Pope would appreciate. Remember, Jews are now being permitted to leave the ghetto. The Pope is treating them with kindness. Yet the Pope's opinion is, and the Pope is insistent, that Judaism is something that's practiced inside, out of view. The idea that Jews are walking down the streets of the ghetto, blasting their music and celebrating, they're supposed to be second-class citizens here. This is something that Chazan knew would not be tolerated for very long, and all the liberalities of the current Pope, Jewish condition, and he was quite liberal, he would see this as incitement and a lot of chutzpah for the Jews to act like they're first class. You know, that's something Christians do. They carry the images of Jesus and they march through the streets on Easter. Jews don't do that. Obviously, we live in a very, very different environment, but I'm sure there are many other countries, especially the Arab world, where the rabbis will not permit anything like that. Now, Avi Sagi is a big scholar in Israel. He's written a lot of books. He's quite unique in that he's also analyzed people like Shimon Shkop and others. He wrote a book, Yahadut Bein Dat LaMusar, Judaism between religion and ethics, religion and morality. He also co-published a number of works. One of the works he co-published was the Tzvi Zohar on the issue of a conversion in modern times that got such a negative review by Michael Broyd. I'm also going to be reviewing the Zohar book, and I give my criticisms, but I also defend them against some of Broyd's criticisms. And one of Broyd's criticisms that he makes Zohar and Sagi out to be just complete ignoramuses. It turns out that no less a figure than Rav Avadya Yosef interprets it the same way that Sagi and Zohar do. And not just Rav Avadya. Bechemdas Shlomo, Rabbi Huda Rotzelhenkin, Rabbi Pinchas Tadano. I have a list of about 11 sources that interpret it just like Sagi and Zohar, and not one source that interprets it the way Broyd does. So in that sense, they deserve to be defended. And I'll be, they commissioned me to do this journal. So he has this book, different chapters, and one of the chapters is devoted to Rabbi Yisrael Moshe Chazan. The title of the chapter is Between Particularism and Universalism. And we already saw that the Chazan has these elements of universalism. And he points out something interesting. First of all, he says he sees Chazan as unique, in that you have a combination of traditional learning and also a recognition of the place for human autonomy and rationality where religion per se is not determinative. That is, there's an area where human rationality assumes great significance. Now, I don't know why this is so, it's not unique in this. We're going to deal with the Dor Ravi in a future class. I mentioned him a few times already, including this semester, his cannibalism business. There's others as well. But, so Chazan's not unique, but he's significant. Chazan speaks about the great significance of our intellect. He says that if it's unclear how to interpret a text, and one way appears to make sense to us, not because of the text itself, but because it fits in with our preconceived notions, our intellect of what Judaism is about, of what makes sense intellectually, that's the approach you should adopt. Because he says the intellect is Dibrei Elohim Chayim. The intellect is divine. And if you're not sure how to interpret the text, and the intellect tells you that this makes more sense, that's a source in and of itself, the intellect. The problem, however, is what do you do when there's a conflict between the intellect, what the intellect sees as basic to morality or natural rights, and the Torah? And Chazan has an example, which goes back to the dispute over inheritance that we dealt with. He says it makes perfect sense that if a woman dies and there are children, that her husband inherits her. However, Chazan says that the natural right, the right built into nature, is that if a woman's married and she has no children and she dies, that the parents inherit her. Now, I don't know why he sees that as natural, like a natural right. Why? If the husband's married to her, then why shouldn't the husband inherit? But he sees this as a natural right and speaks very strongly about this. I'm assuming he's influenced by perhaps even some Christian natural law theorists. However, here we have a conflict. Because according to the Torah, obviously the husband inherits. Chazan says, and here I think he's being anachronistic, so more significant is what he says, the outcome of what he says, not the rationale. He says that already in medieval times they recognized this conflict between natural law and Torah law, and in Toledo they made a takana, a decree, that if a woman dies childless, half of her estate goes to her parents. This is in Shulot HaRosh, number 55. I think it's probably anachronistic because, I mean, there's all sorts of ways to understand this. It could be that in those days people were arguing. They didn't think it was fair, but not that there's some concept of natural law. It's just like we saw with the Moroccans, that if there's an issue, if people aren't accepting the Torah law the way it is, so the rabbis have room to make takanot. But listen to what Chazan says. Chachmei HaRishonim lo yachlu lisbol davar zeh. The great the sages of the medieval sages could not suffer this in seeing the great pain that came to those who were the cause for the woman, that is, who brought the woman into this world, namely her parents. And they see that, he uses a words here, a short of vuacha, a slaughtered animal, and yet this is the woman. And this stranger, the Baal, Ishzar, he comes and takes it all. And that's what he says, that the Rush saw a conflict here between natural rights and Torah law, and that's the reason why he institutes this Takana. I think this is a very problematic assertion. If you say that Torah law is one thing, change, circumstances have changed, that's the whole reason why we have Takanot. People won't lend money without interest anymore, so we invent a heteriska. We dealt with this in great detail with the Moroccan takanot. That makes sense. You say Torah law is only suitable for a time when women are getting married at age 13. Now that they're living to 80, they're not getting married until their 20s or 30s. It doesn't work, that they shouldn't inherit. You can give all those things, and the Moroccans did. But with the takanot, to give a woman, to give half of the woman's estate back to her parents, if you said that it's not because of economic or social changes since the days of the Torah, no, that would make sense. You could even say that you have to do this to the husband, so the father can marry off the other children. But when you say that there's a natural right for parents to inherit the daughter when the daughter dies childless, and this is a natural right, not due to changing circumstances, then how could the Torah ever have given the inheritance to the husband? You must assume that the Torah rejected this natural right, because if it's a natural right, it existed at the time of giving of the Torah. And since the Torah does not follow this natural right and it awards property to the husband, this shows that the Torah rejects this natural right. So then how can you come later and say, even though the Torah says this, we're going to nevertheless make a takana? The whole idea of the takana is to say that what the Torah said doesn't apply anymore. Because the circumstances have changed, and the Torah never intended it to apply. So I don't know. This, to me, makes very little sense, and he says it. And he says that's what the Rush thinks. I find it very problematic. Tzagi doesn't mention this problem. He points out this fascinating point, but he doesn't get to what I see as the real problem. Perhaps you could say, although Chazan doesn't say this, perhaps you could say that the natural right was only recognized many years after the Torah was given, almost a Maimonidean thing. So this is the only way I think you could explain this, that the Torah is given in an era where they're not yet at the stage of recognizing the natural rights, and then the Torah gives the inheritance to the husband. But later years, when this, with the development of their intellect, whatever you want to say, when this natural right is now recognized, it always existed, but it wasn't recognized because the earlier generations were not able to recognize this. This is very Maimonidean. The Rambam speaks about with sacrifices, with God's corporeality, that the earlier generations didn't know things that later generations did. Then you have to deal with it. Perhaps that's one way of looking at it. I think a lot of the modern Orthodox feminists basically use a similar thing. They want to update things even in the Torah, and they'll say, well, the Torah was given in an era where people did not recognize, just like the Rambam says about sacrifices, they didn't recognize the woman's whole personality. So we're not rejecting the Torah, we're just saying the Torah never intended it. So perhaps that's his point. I'll just mention a few more interesting responses briefly, so because I want to conclude with Chazan. We can go on for at least another class or two, but it's time to move on soon to the Rambam. In Krach Shel Romi number 4, he forbids making the covers of the Ark, the Aron Kodesh. That's a very unusual position, I think, because almost every shul has those pictures. In number 6, he has a very interesting tshuva. He says that there is no obligation, no halacha of tefillah b'tzibur, of davening with a minyan for an individual. That's a communal obligation. The community is responsible for creating a public service, but there's no obligation on me particularly, or you as an individual. It's a good thing to go, but there's no obligation. Why is this relevant? Why do I point it out? Because if this is correct, then you can't say that the reason a woman can't be motzi, can't fulfill a man's obligation to tefillah, as a chazan, for example, is that women are not obligated to tefillah b'tzibur. Because no one is obligated into tefillah b'tzibur. I actually pointed this out to Judith Hauptman. Judith Hauptman had a whole article on women and minyan, that women can be counted in a minyan, and tried to show, even though men have this obligation, women still accept the obligation on themselves, all sorts of stuff like that. And I emailed her and I said, why do you assume that there's any obligation for men to daven in a minyan? That would make her case a lot easier. If no one has an obligation, then of course she can count women. And she actually repeated this point in response to criticism of her article, but she didn't attribute it to Mark Shapiro, even though I was the one who pointed it out to her. The first person, to my knowledge, to make the case that the reason you can't include a woman in a minyan is because a woman does not have this, that a man has an obligation to feel tzibur, davening in the community, and a woman does not have this obligation, and therefore a woman cannot be included in the minyan. She certainly can't be a chazan, because we know a chazan can only be someone who has the same obligation. You can't have a child, for example, be a chazan, fulfill the obligation. But counting in a minyan, everyone has to have the same obligation. If a man has an obligation in public prayer, a woman doesn't, obviously a woman can't be counted. As far as I know, if I'm correct me if I'm wrong, Rav Ruvi Margolios, a 20th century authority in his Margolios Hayam, is the first one to put forth this idea. And yet Chazan rejects it. And he goes further. I don't know what you mean, Dov, when you say that Shulchan Aruch. I'm going to get to what Shulchan Aruch says in a minute. He has an ambiguous language. The communal obligation of minyan only applies to a minyan of men. I'm not sure. You could say that, but maybe that's he doesn't say that though. Only men have the responsibility to ensure that there's a minyan. That's true. Only men have the responsibility. Women don't. The question is, why can't you count a woman in the minyan if she has the same obligation? If neither men nor women have an obligation in public prayer, and women have an obligation in, let's say, the morning prayer, the same as a man. And we have actually proofs. According to some, at least, a woman can be counted in a minyan for, let's say, Megillas Esther, or for something in for Sumei Nisa. And you need to have, let's say, if, for example, you have to give up your life for something and you need 10 people, that makes it public. They're asking you to violate a certain mitzvah and you have to give up your life in public. Since women share the same obligation, they are regarded in that context as a minion. And the reason given is because they share the same obligation, and since they can be counted as the minion. So we have this notion that Chazan says that there is no obligation for men to have a minion. Now, why does he say this? He doesn't just say it for the sake of it. Okay, I'm going to get to that, Dov. Does the Talmud Chacham too? But look at the language. He doesn't say you're obligated. He says yishtadel. So I'm going to get to. Chazan points to that. So let me get my Shulchan Aruch here. Let me tell you why he wants to say this. He actually wants to use this for a chumrah, not for a kula. He's not saying this so you don't need to get up anymore to go to minyan. We all assume, by the way, there's no obligation. I say there's an obligation. Go places, you go away. No one ever says that there's a problem. You're missing a minyan. So, city. But I'll read you what Shulchan Aruch says in a minute. What happened was he was asked a certain question. There was a man who lived outside of the city. There wasn't a neighbor, or outside of the tchum, whatever it was, and he wanted to hire a non-Jew. Let's keep falling here. He wanted to hire a non-Jew to push him. So have a carriage, and bring him on the carriage to shul on Shabbos. We saw the Eretz Chemda responsum last semester, the semester before, where they actually permit, we spoke about this in great deal, hiring a non-Jew, take an old person who can't get out to go to shul on Shabbos. Chazan says it's forbidden to not have a non-Jew bring a Jew to shul on Shabbos in his cart. The people who wanted to permit it said that it's a mitzvah to daven. When you say it's a mitzvah, I don't even know if they're saying it's a chiyuv, but it's sort of like where Moshe finds it called a mitzvah kiyumis. We have this concept sometimes that you fulfill a mitzvah even though you're not obligated. It seems to go against the general notion that a mitzvah by definition means obligation. But either they were saying it's an obligation to daven with a minyan if you can. So, for example, the Shulchan Aruch speaks about, as we'll see in a minute, if you're a certain distance away, then obviously if there's no minyan within 20 miles, it's not an obligation. But if you're close, you could say that it's an obligation. Or even maybe they're saying a little less than that, that when you go there, you fulfill the mitzvah. In any event, Yisrael Moshe Chazan says no. It's just a nice thing, there's no mitzvah, and therefore you can't violate Shabbos. If the Tefillah of a Tzibur was, you could. Now, so here he's using it for a stringency. But he, in the midst of it, he's saying that there's no obligation to daven the Tefillah of a Tzibur. He's not only that, he says there's no mitzvah, even rabbinically. So it's not just there's no obligation. He says you do not fulfill any mitzvah. It's only a nice thing. Rav Avadya Yosef, if you're looking at Bia Omer, volume 6, number Arachim 10, he says this is an exaggeration. He quotes Yisrael Moshe Chazan, and he says this is an exaggeration. Why is it an exaggeration? Because if you look at what Dov pointed out, Shulchan Aruch, Arachim 90:16, well, this is a different one. The Shulchan Aruch is saying that if you're going on the way, and you come to a city, and you want to stay overnight there, if you can go 4 miles, let's say, you're going, let's say, from Boston down to New York, so you're going south. You want to stay at this motel, but there's no minyan, and yet you can go. If you go 4 miles ahead of you, you can find a minyan. You're obligated, even though you're tired, to continue. Continue in that direction to get to a minyan, if there's a place that you could stay there. And you'd have to even go backwards at least 1 mile. You don't have to go backwards 4 miles, because that takes you out of your way, but you have to go backwards a little. So this clearly shows that davening with the minyan is not just something, well, take it or leave it. It's a positive thing. However, Chazan agrees it's positive. But it's not a mitzvah, and he brings a proof. Tractate Berachot 7b, where Rav Isaac, I'll just read it for you in English. Rav Isaac asked Rav Nachman, why do you not come to the synagogue to pray? He says, I can't. You physically couldn't. He asked him, why not gather 10 people in your house and pray there? That's a common thing. We have houses. And he answered, it's too much trouble. It's too much trouble. So he poo-poos. Rav Nachman in the Gemara is poo-pooing the idea of a minyan. That's not such a big deal. And we know, past, that in yeshivas and other places, they didn't take minyan that seriously. Rabbi Chiyuk of Weinberg talks about how when he was a yeshiva bacher, he didn't daven mincha with a minyan. He's busy learning, so I guess if you're involved in the mitzvah, you're putter. A complete discussion of it is actually found in this sefer, Ateret Paz, by a big love in Israel. His name is Avichi. This is in volume 2, page 397, and he quotes all the sources, and Chazan's view is a minority view. But he also quotes the view of the Aderis, which I think is interesting. The Aderis himself, the great Eliel Rabinowitz Teomim, the father-in-law of Rav Kook, who's published many books, he says, if you have a chance of praying in your sukkah, daven in a sukkah, or go to daven at shul, he says it's better to daven in your sukkah. And he says, myself, every time that I went to shul, to daven, and left the sukkah, why did he go? I guess he's the Rav, so he has to go, because he's the Rav of the city. Every time I would leave my sukkah, where I could daven, and go to shul to daven, he says it bothered me very much. It affected me very much. Does mitzvah sukkah chavivali? And what's davening with a minyan? Davening with a minyan in Sibur is not such an important, is not as important as this. And even without this, we are lenient anyway. Many people don't daven with a minyan, etc. As we see, we look around, we see lots of people don't daven in the minyan. Saying, here I have a chance of davening in a sukkah. People are lenient davening with a minyan anyway. Why can't I just stay in the sukkah and daven? So this position is quoted by all the authorities, Rav Chaim Sofer, and anyone who discusses the notion of minyan has to deal with Rav Yisrael Moshe Chazan, because his whole case is that davening with a minyan is a nice thing, but it's not even a rabbinic thing. And he used that, as I said, for a chumrah. Paradoxically, almost, if the conservatives knew about this, they could have used this to justify counting women in a minyan. Forget the conservatives now. You have the left-wing orthodox. They figured out now you could have minyans where women daven Pesukah D'Zimra, read the Torah. They figured out all sorts of stuff. Lead Kabbalah Shabbos. If they want to count women in a minyan, is a perfect way to count them in a minyan. I already told you I have sources from 19th century and 18th century Acharon who sees, according to Rabban, you can count women in a minyan. The Shulchan Aruch says you can't, but okay, so we don't hold by the Shulchan Aruch will say in that, then you could use Rishon Moshe Chazan. If they're, one day, if when they discover this, maybe that'll be the next reform. Okay, before we go further, I'm just about finished with Rishon Moshe Chazan. Let me just see what some of these comments are here. Okay, so when you're there, but what does it mean? The question is, when you say it's a mitzvah to daven, or the rabbinic mitzvah to daven with the sefer, what does that mean, mitzvah? Are we going to say it's an obligation? Some will say it's an obligation if you don't have anything else. Others will say it's more of like a kiyumis, like Rav Moshe Feinstein says about living in the land of Israel, that if you do it, you take part in a commandment, but it's not an obligatory commandment that everyone has to do. But it's still a good thing. All these things of Rishon Moshe Chazan. In fact, read you with the Aderis. He uses a very interesting terminology about minyan. He says davening in Sibur and in the shul is just snifla mitzvah. It's just like a branch. It's a help. So what's the mitzvah? I think the mitzvah is kavana. That is, you can daven with more kavana in a shul. So that's why we go daven with the minyan, because we have more kavana there. But if you have a choice of davening in a sukkah, where there's actually a concept of davening in a sukkah, he says that's more significant because a minyan is only to give you more kavanah, but it has no inherent significance. These are minority views, though. Bukin Zavichi and others, or Vavadia, the standard view is it's certainly a rabbinic mitzvah, either meaning an obligatory mitzvah, if you can, or just something that you participate in this mitzvah. That's how I understand it. That's a big machlokes, Dov Weinstein, about Netzach Chama. I said already that in the Lithuanian yeshivas, no one was davening at Netzach Chama. They actually were up to 2, 3 in the morning. They would sleep late, and they would miss the minyan. And they justified it by saying that Talmud Torah, if you're Osek, if you're involved with Talmud Torah, you can miss the minyan. If you went to Borough Park, when I was young, I used to go when some of my Shabbat to Borough Park, the Bluj of a Rebbe. He never came down for a minyan. He was always up in his room, upstairs, he had better kavana, whatever it is. The Bujav Revi is the one Yaffa Eliach discusses so much in Hasidic Tales of the Holocaust. So Dovi Hoffman points out, Yeah, what is better, Tefillah B'Nates, davening by yourself at an earlier time? And forget at an earlier time. What about davening? There's tshuvas to me in published tshuvas, including one in Mishnah Halachot by my favorite posek, Rav Menashe Klein. What's better, davening not with the minyan at the proper time, or davening with the minyan after the proper time? Believe it or not, you will not find this settled in the Aruch HaShulchan, in the Mishnah Berurah. The case was at Brandeis when I was there, that sometimes we couldn't get a minyan, and we call someone, but by the time the person got there, it would be after the Zman, the time of Tefillah. So do you wait for the person to come and daven with the minyan, or is it more important to daven with the proper time? I asked three poskim about this. I asked Rav Mordechai Eliyahu, and Rav Mordechai Eliyahu said that you have to daven by yourself, because if the guy gets here and you wait for him, and as you wait for him, you show him that he can wake up late, and there'll still be a minyan. So that way, don't wait for him. He'll come. He'll see that he missed it, that everyone missed Tefillah B'Tzibur, and therefore he'll come earlier. Menashe Klein says the exact opposite, that if you daven by yourself, even after you called him, as we called him, and the guy never came on time, and we either can wait 5 more minutes and daven with a minyan, or we have to daven now, it's the Zman, Menashe Klein says you have to wait, because if he comes and you woke him up, and he gets there, and he sees that you started without him, he'll be very discouraged, and he won't come again. So Mordechai Eliyahu and Menashe Klein, on their understanding of human psychology, come to the exact opposite conclusion. One person will see it as he misses the minyan, that means he has to come faster. The other will see he won't want to come at all. But a lot of discussion about this. Okay, that's interesting, Dovi, about what the Mabit says, but it's still just then rabbinic. I mean, historically, the idea of minyan is no doubt a rabbinic thing. Okay, so all of you afterwards, you can certainly scroll up and see these wonderful sources by the Talmidei Chachamim we have writing on here. And for those who are downloading it, it's better to watch them now, because you miss out on all this good stuff. Okay, good stuff. One more thing I want to point out. In Tshuva number 8, Chazan says that we're in an era and what his comments could apply to our era also. He says there are some rabbis who are throwing out halacha, he's referring to reform rabbis, and there are others who are saying all they say is forbidden, forbidden, forbidden. Both of these approaches are incorrect. He says that if the rabbis show, how do the rabbis appeal to the people? If they show they understand the contemporary circumstances, that religion and knowledge are not in opposition, that the rabbis permit something when they're able to permit it, then the people will listen when they forbid. But if all they do is forbid, respect for the rabbis. Finally, the Krach Shalromi has the most detailed response on the status of a suicide. Like almost 20 double-sided pages. Most comprehensive in the entire rabbinic literature. There's a book called Suicide in Rabbinic Literature by Sidney Goldstein. You didn't know about this responsum. One of the interesting things about this responsum is it's also a defense of this book, Summing Rosh, that Dan Rabinowitz in his class on Torah and Moshe this semester has dealt with. This is a forgery of Shaul Berlin, the 18th century Shaul Berlin, and one of the forged responsa there basically justifies suicide. If you're feeling upset or sad, he justifies it. Chazan, offers all sorts of arguments to show why the Besamim Rosh and why this responsum in particular are authentic. And this is a good example of how someone could be so certain of something and yet be so wrong in every respect. I don't have time now to go into the Besamim Rosh. This edition that came out, in the 1980s, in the back has notes, and of course, they cite Yisrael Moshe Chazan. One final point, I mentioned this in my book on Rabbi Chaya of Weinberg, Rabbi Yisrael Moshe Chazan is the first person to say, more people are saying, but he was the first, that, not defending anti-Semitism, but he says some people are anti-Semitic because they saw that how Jews act. They saw what Jewish books say. And rather than Jews recognizing that some of these comments are about wicked Gentiles of old, they apply them in practice. And he says, for some non-Jews, this is what's led them to anti-Semitism. Whether it's true or not, I don't know. Shadal says the same thing, and Rabbi Chirak of Weinberg says the same thing. And although they won't say it publicly, many of the rabbis in America have been whispering that, you know, when you have Madoff, and you have Rubashkin, and you have this, and you have that, it's amazing that we don't have more anti-Semitism. Shaul Moshe Chazan is really the first person that I know of to point out that maybe it's, at least in some respects, you can put some of the blame on the Jews. And that the Jews, said that certain texts of theirs are not applicable, et cetera, that things would be a little better. But it's those sort of comments that the Sicily Ezra really go to town on. Now, with this, we conclude the classes on Rosh Hashanah Moshe Chazan. We'll pick up immediately next time with the famous Ridbaz, Jacob David Wolofsky. Here's his picture for those. We'll get back to him next class. For now, let me look at the comments and the questions. Thought Shiach of Rosh Hashanah Moshe Chazan. And by the way, David Eisen, in one of the classes you weren't here, I explained why your suggestion that he had to call himself Mashiach, because Rosh Hashanah Moshe Chazan is Yamach. Although he could call himself, I pointed out, Yismach, and in a couple of places he does. So I decided to reject your suggestion, but thank you. Wolofsky, or Yaakov David Wolofsky, also plenty of fascinating stuff, interesting stuff, historically significant stuff. It takes us from Italy in the mid-19th century to Orthodoxy in America for the 20th century. How many people are familiar with it? They have this impression that it was a complete desert here, a complete midbar. And yet, Gedolei Yisrael were found in America. Rabbis who, if they were in Europe, would have been regarded as leaders of the generation and important works. And so we'll get a glimpse into that when we deal with starting next week. So let me look at some of the questions and comments here. I'm going to raise the brightness on the screen here so I can see the questions a little better. Let's see, what do we have here? Nachum Mendel. Okay, that's interesting. We have many examples of great rabbis, and I mentioned Rabbi Chirak of Weinberg and others who were not mocked on Minyan. I think for many of them, the issue was that they're learning Torah. So if they're learning Torah, and then they have to get up and they have to walk to the shul, one thing if there was a Minyan at the house, but they don't want to make a Minyan to the house because then they have to bring the Bachrim over. It's Bittul Zman. They have to walk sometimes 10 minutes to get to the there and back, and if they're in the middle of a sugya, well, then let's say the minyan is at 6 o'clock, but they're in the middle of learning now, and they don't want to interrupt themselves, so they'll daven at 7 o'clock. You have many great rabbis that acted this way, especially in the Ritzi Yehuda, would not always be mocked, but on minyan doesn't surprise me. Is that a joke, Ethan? Or see Yehuda having trouble with kosher certification? I'm not sure. Okay, so now we have contemporary testimony that Rav Avadi Yosef says he disagrees with the Adaris. I can understand. If everyone says you're supposed to, it's better to daven by yourself in the sukkah, then you can close up the minyans. Although I guess you could have a minyan in your sukkah. But he tells us that Rabbi Zabichi, who I quoted before, he davens in his sukkah by himself. I don't know, Rabbi Yosef davens in his house a lot, so he probably has minyan in his sukkah. He has the best of both worlds. Any event, what is this idea of davening in a sukkah? There's no halacha, there's no mitzvah to daven in your sukkah. Why should davening in your sukkah, be... Yechidus be better than davening with a minyan. The Adaris makes a whole point that there's no inyan of a mitzvah of davening in a minyan. Well, where's the inyan? Where's the idea that you have to daven in a sukkah? So you say it's a nice thing. So it's a nice thing to daven with a minyan too. So I find it a difficult position. Well, we're going to deal a lot, Ethan, with the kashrus. I will have a lot to say. Many of you know that the history of kashrus in America is one of my interests. So I will have a lot to say about kashrus, because kashrus disputes that took place in America, you think the kashrus disputes that go on today are bad. You'll hear the stuff you're going to hear. Okay, well, let me just, I don't want to give it away. There'll be a lot to say to you next week. Violence. Mobsters. Beating people up. Poisoning food. I mean, this is all part of the story of kashrus in America, and we'll get to that. Yeah, okay, but again, Ovadia, that raises the question that it's almost quasi-antinomian, that you're going to, everyone individual can decide chavivus a mitzvah they want. If a Kabbalist said it, it would be one thing, but for a Litvish Rav to say it, look, Rabbi Soloveitchik has comments like this also. Chaim Soloveitchik would make things, comments like this also. So, I'm just saying, to me, it strikes me as a bit strange, because to make the whole point that there's no inyan of a minyan, and then where do you get this idea that davening in a sukkah is, I mean, we eat in a sukkah. So you live in a sukkah. Okay, you live in a sukkah, but the minyan is not in your sukkah, so you go to the shul to have a minyan. And that's the mainstream position. But okay, he's... yes, I will make mention to that that work. Harold Gastworth, by the way, is today known as Zvi Gastworth, living in Israel, Flatbush graduate. If I forget to... because I don't have the book with me. I don't own it. It's possible to get now. But the University of Scranton has it, but I returned it. I'm not going to be able to get it. So you'll remind me to talk about it. But I don't need that. I'll tell you why, Ethan. Because I have this book. Two volumes against the Ritvaz, complete with all the contracts and the documents and everything. And then I have the Ritvaz's attacks on that and all the other discussions. So Gastworth only gives about 3 pages dealing with the Ritvaz. I have hundreds of pages here about the machlokas of the Ritvaz. Okay, wait a few more minutes. Is there any comments? There'll be more about kashrus when I deal with Rav Hengen also. Well, there's a lot about kashrus in America. Wait 2 more minutes. I see Vadi and Yisrael are typing. I think there's only 3 more classes this semester, because then I go to Florida, and I hope at least some of you will, when they say $10, it's $10 Canadian. I hope some of you will join us for the talk on... although if you're a chassid, maybe you can't do it, because we will be learning at least some Torah on Christmas Eve. But I think you'll find it interesting. I've uploaded some strange stuff, and why don't you bring this all back? Mention that next time we do it. But the tshuva, the Abba Chachma, attacks the rugged shover. I didn't recall anything about the Ritvaz in there. You have to remind me. That's by I had his picture even. That's the Yudel Evitz. I showed his picture on my blog, and I mentioned that response in, where he attacks the rugged shover, but I didn't remember anything about the Ritvaz there. So let me know. No, I didn't do Ashkenazic and Sephardic, but the next class, first class dealing with the Ritvaz, I'm going to deal with the Ritvaz's attack on the Brisker method of Torah study, a Talmud study, and when I deal with the Brisker method and why he criticizes it, I will then get into the differences, the Ashkenazic and the Sephardic approach to Talmud study. Talk then later. I just want Ovadia to tell me one more thing, and then if no one has anything else, wish everyone good night. No, but I don't think Yudel Levitz mentions the Ritvaz there. He attacks the... he attacks the rugged shover there. I spoke about this Yudel Levitz. Some of you might recall Yudel Levitz is the one I dealt with. He was the Rav in Manchester, and when the community members wanted to get rid of him, they hired a group of prostitutes to go in his carriage, so he'd come out to his carriage, and they'd be sitting there, and that was their sign to him that it was time for him to go. I quoted this in my last three posts ago in the Sfarim blog. I heard that from Louis Jacobs, who grew up in Manchester. And this was obviously Tarsha Balpeh, 20-some, 30-some years after the event happened. He comes to America, and he maybe was the greatest genius at that time in the 1910s and 1920s in America. But he had some strange views. Okay, well then, I think we're at the end tonight. I look forward to seeing everyone. Tell your friends, by the way, if you want. I know Torah Moshe wants to expand the people involved. We have over 100 signed up, about 110, 115 signed up, but we're only getting 35, 40, 45 a class, so they really want to spread the word. But we'll see you next Monday night, same time, to deal with the famous Ridbaz. Good night, everyone.